Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello and welcome to Comedy Album Book Club. This is Matt. This episode I had the pleasure of chatting with sketch comedy duo Claire Blackwood and Ryan Hughes, also known as Whiskey Kids. You may remember Ryan from the time he appeared on the show previously with Grace Smith to talk about Beth Stelling's Simply the Beth. They joined me in a virtual pizza party to watch the film Easy A. Easy A is a 2010 film written by Burt B. Royal and directed by Will Gluck, starring Emma Stone in one of her earliest leading film roles. It tells the story of Olive Pendergast, a whip-smart and sassy high school student. While studying the Scarlet Letter, she finds herself in a situation mirroring that of Hester Prynne. She navigates through the trials and tribulations that are thrown at her, ultimately forging her own path. This is a delightful film that has a stacked cast, including Emma Stone, Amanda Bynes, Lisa Kudrow, Thomas Hayden Church, Patricia Clarkson, and the woefully underused Malcolm McDowell, just to name a few. This is one of those rare films that, while aimed at teenagers, it doesn't condescend, and it doesn't immediately make you think that the writer is a 40-year-old man turning his hat backwards and sitting on a chair looking to jam with the kids. As always, we suggest you watch the film before listening to the podcast. It's available on Netflix for easy access. The podcast will be full of spoilers, so you've been warned. Thanks again for tuning in, and welcome to Comedy Album Book Club. Welcome to Comedy Album Book Club. Today I sat with Ryan Hughes and Claire Blackwood, and writers, improvisers, actors, and all-around just amazing performers. They make up the duo Whiskey Kids, and we watched the movie Easy A. So before we get into the actual movie, just to tell the audiences a little bit about you, what first drew you both to performing, and what was sort of like your trigger to eventually like really like go into comedy?
Ooh, do you want to take this first, Ryan?
Yeah, sure. I'm one of these lifelong drama kids, you know. I've been doing school plays since I was in grade six or whatever. Went to theater school twice for two different things. I didn't fail. Although maybe in a larger sense I did fail. I've been like sort of an artsy performing guy for forever. And then when I moved to Toronto in 2010 or something like that, you know, all my whole theater world was in Edmonton, where I'm from. So I got out here, and like any theater scene, it tends to be very insular. It's very hard to sort of break in. Everybody knows each other. Everybody's kind of got all those sort of patterns of interaction and everything. So, you know, I just found that I couldn't be a theater boy here. And I think I was old enough that I felt like I didn't have the energy to like kick in the doors like you gotta do. So I think it was honestly as random as like I met like a woman who was a stand-up comedian at some dinner party, and I went and checked out a couple of stand-up shows that she invited me to, and met some people, and then eventually got into improv and comedy, and think it's way easier to get comedy off the ground in this town. I just sort of ended up sticking with that.
Yeah, I think mine was actually like, yeah, I was a theater kid. I had done mostly Shakespeare for most of my career in Toronto after graduating theater school. And then Ryan and I wrote a show together for Fringe. And then honestly, like that was kind of the start of my kind of comedy adventures, because we just kind of were like, oh, we like working together, let's start making comedy. And then I did the, you know, Second City Conservatory and all that kind of stuff. So it's basically been the last 2 years roughly that I've really kind of gotten more into writing and comedy and all that kind of fun stuff. I think kind of apropos to what Ryan was saying, one of the greatest tweets I've ever seen was Kaya Green. I don't remember what the context was, but they basically just said, comedians are just tired actors.
I haven't heard that, but that's a good one.
Was like, that is 1,000% true, and absolutely signified my entrance into comedy, which is just, I got sick of pushing against theater doors that just weren't opening, and I was like, well, fuck you guys, then I'm gonna do comedy. And yeah, kind of just gone from there.
And that collaboration on that show that you wrote, that was that the birth of Whiskey Kids?
No, well, I mean, it was the birth of us working together.
Yeah.
But like, I don't think Whiskey Kids was about a year. About 6 months later.
I think so. Yeah. Well, because we kind of knew each other as sort of like theater kids. I think we met at like some sort of it was like some sort of like commercial audition workshop or something like that a casting director was doing. So we knew each other as sort of like these soon to be tired actors, to borrow Kaya's phrasing. And we'd like run into each other every 6 months or something. But then, I think Claire was set to do like a two-hander with another performer that they were going to write together. And then he ended up getting some opportunity. He had to leave town. So suddenly she needed a collaborator for this Fringe show with like, was it 2 months to go or?
Yep.
Yeah. So we kind of banged out our first show and it went pretty well. And so we just sort of kept at it. And I don't know how much of a part I played in this, but I do remember Claire kind of browbeating you into like auditioning for the conservatory program.
Oh. You were absolutely the reason.
There was a certain amount of time where you were convinced that, like, I don't know how to be funny, I don't know how to do improv, and I don't know. I'm like, look, if they let me in, they'll let you in. Don't worry about it.
That was pretty much it.
And so what inspired choosing Easy A today?
I think we were honestly just, like, to be super boring about it, I think we were just kind of going through Netflix and being like, what comedy movies are on there that either we both like or one of us likes and the other person hasn't seen, which is the case for Easy A. We just settled on this one because it was one that we both agreed on.
Well, and I hadn't seen it, but like I always heard really good things about it. And I just like Emma Stone. I'm not super familiar with her work. I haven't seen her in a lot of stuff, but I just kind of like her vibe. Please don't tell me that she's a monster.
She's not. She's great. Yeah.
Everything I've heard is she's a wonderful human being.
Yeah. Good. So I was, you know, and I'd heard it was a clever movie, and then Claire was like super into it. So I was like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah,
awesome. It's, I've seen Easy A like 10 times at least. I love it.
Yeah. I have to, watching this really reminded me, like, what the hell is with California high schools?
I know!
Because like every, and it's not just this movie, it's like every movie I watch where it's
bring it setting on. Up, it's like, yeah.
They're bigger than York University. You know, like the campuses are sprawling.
Yeah.
But yeah, so do you have, like, I'll start with you, Claire, since you're more familiar with the film, do you have a favorite scene or a favorite moment or performance in the movie?
I mean, I will watch Stanley Tucci and Patricia Clarkson play parents literally till the day I die. Like, yeah. They are so friggin' funny and charming, and I mean, I love Stanley Tucci in everything that he does. I think he's brilliant. He's one of my favorite actors, and Patricia is just so wonderful and funny and warm, and like, and I just sit there, and I mean, I have wonderful parents, and I'm sitting there just being like, oh, you guys are the best. So basically any scene, because I feel like so much, I feel like they probably were just like, yeah, you guys just improvised a bit, we'll see what you do. I feel like a lot of their dialogue was probably heavily improvised by them.
Yeah. A lot of those cutaway lines of Stanley Tucci is like, I kind of feel like those are ones where they just kind of left the camera like that, mm-hmm. where he sits down and there's like a their adopted son and he's, so where are you from originally?
Oh my God.
There's no way that was in the script. That was just Stanley Tucci.
Yeah.
Just riffing. Yeah.
Riffing.
The thing I love about it too is like, you know, you watch some shows like Gilmore Girls, which I, you know, I love, you know, Mrs. Maisel, where there's the quippiness to the parents. It doesn't feel forced. Like this feels like this could just genuinely be those two people. I mean, it is pretty quip intensive, but it never feels like, oh, this is no parents are like this kind of thing.
No, they're both actors have like a very similar, lovely, warm quality to them that I think I you just kind of got the sense that they just loved being on set together. At least I hope they did.
It's a trick with these kind of movies, right? Because you have these, so often in these movies you have these teens that are sort of clever and wise beyond their years, mostly because they're being written by like 35-40 year olds. And this is a kind of a nice way to fold that in, because like this is exactly the kind of teenage girl that would come into existence raised by two people like that.
Yeah.
And they all just have like, they're all very smart. They're all very like sort of, they have the same ridiculous sense of humor. They've got a high level of reference, as they say in comedy. So it makes sense to, I was like, oh, it's one of these quippy 17-year-olds, you know?
And they even kind of establish that too in the cutback or flashback to the 7 minutes in heaven, where it's like, how do you talk like an adult? Like, how do you do that? So it's like, there's like underpinnings to the narrative. It's not just, oh, she's just it just doesn't come out of nowhere kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And is there a performance or scene that really pops for you, Ryan?
Oh, man. I mean, this almost seems like the easy A for answer, because, it's Emma Stone, right? Like, it's her movie. You know, and of course, like, she's got the most screen time. She's got, so, like, of course, she has the opportunity to kill it harder than anyone else, but, like, she kills it twice as hard as that, I almost feel. Although, I gotta say, I did make a note, leaving aside Emma Stone, just because, like, obviously she's the lead. Every time I see Lisa Kudrow in something, I feel... Because I was a too cool for school teenager when Friends was on the air back in the 90s. And I feel very bad about how dismissive I was of so many of those actors.
Yeah.
Especially Lisa Kudrow. Because she is such a good actor, comedically, dramatically. She can just walk an amazing dark line. And like, you know, and I feel bad that I wrote her off for so many years because I wanted to be cooler than Friends or whatever.
Yeah, like her meltdowns are just beautiful to watch, because there's just like great. that energy, and there's like a storm that's being bound up that you just see just below the surface. And it's a delight to watch because it's not, it never strays into, it just walks that line between ridiculous and real really, really well. And yeah, so she's terrific. Yeah, I have to agree though. I think Emma Stone was my, I mean, like coming into this movie, she'd only been acting professionally for about 5 years by that
point. She was 21.
She'd been doing it for 5 years. She had 16, but by that point, it's a heavy 5 years. She had 6 TV credits, 2 of which she was a lead in, and 7 film credits. But this was, I think, her first, her first major film lead where she was the central character. Like, do you feel this is kind of, like, for me, like, watching it, I know I do, but, like, do you feel this is kind of where there's the Emma Stone character?
This was her star maker. This was her movie.
So I feel like after this, like, this is, like, people realize, oh, no, this is the person for these types of roles.
She's got a very specific vibe. That
quirky, sarcastic, charming girl.
Well, and I find that a lot of actors, a lot of young actors kind of have that where, like, they'll be working for a while and they're good and they're fine, but it's like there's always that sort of one role or that first time that they're, like, a lead in something where they finally, like, you just, something drops in and you just see that, this is their thing. You know?
I remember this was the first movie in my entire life that I watched and I was really angry that I didn't get cast in her role. It was the first time that I was like, oh my God, this part was made for me. Like I could ever be Emma Stone. But yeah, I think it's a perfect vehicle for her. And then you have Amanda Bynes, who I love playing a character that, like, she doesn't normally play.
Yeah.
She does it so well. Like,
She's very funny.
Yeah.
Like, there's a higher power that will judge you for your indecency. Like,
No, capital.
Yeah, no. Well, because when I was going to playwriting school in Montreal, there were 2 English-speaking channels on the television, and one of them was YTV. And they would run a lot of, like, these sort of, like, Nickelodeon-style sitcoms aimed at sort of tweens and teens. And Amanda Bynes was in one of those, and I think it was kind of her breakout thing. It was like, What I Like About You, or maybe that was just the name of the... That was the theme song of it.
I think it was also what it was called.
And I remember, like, watching that, and that show was not great, but she was very good in it. And I remember thinking, like, oh, this girl is pretty cool. And then, but she was always goofier versions of the Emma Stone kind of thing, usually. Yeah. And then it was really interesting to see her as kind of a sympathetic villain in this one.
Yeah.
Which is not, I don't think I've ever seen her do that outside of this movie.
No. She retired from acting after watching this movie.
Yeah, that's true
too,
as well. Yeah.
I think she was like, I don't know the logic, but it's kind of a shame because she is really great in this, and it shows there's a range to her abilities beyond that one sitcom-y kind of character that she.
Well, it was because her childhood was such a fucking mess because she basically had a mental breakdown. So fun story for everyone listening.
She's actually not sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's not. She's got a lot of stuff to deal with, and it seems like she is dealing with it, which is good. But it's sad that it kind of derailed what I thought was a pretty good career.
Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly honest, She's the Man is like my favorite guilty pleasure movie of all time. Like I know it by heart. It's perfect.
Now, watching it, I found like. For a movie that's so heavy in references to pop culture and stuff, it's interesting because it feels like it really, to me, it inverts the manic pixie dream girl trope. Like it takes it and turns it on its head in a way, because it's like this was filmed and released in 2010, which I kind of feel like looking at the types of movies that came out and like just preceding it and then after it, it was sort of like the peak Manic Pixie Dream Girl movie era, you know, like 500 Days of Summer and all of that jazz. So where if you have a sharp, quirky character, but instead of making it an aspirational target, instead of Emma Stone being the aspirational dream girl of a male protagonist, it's actually showing it through her her perspective and Olive's perspective and and sort of like just saying like, no, this is bullshit. These people have agency. Like, I feel it gave agency to these types of characters that were often mistreated.
Interesting. Yeah. I would almost disagree with your, like, with the crux of that point in the sense that I don't think this was ever supposed to be related to those kind of female characters whatsoever, because it completely just, like, defies what those characters are. Like, I don't think there's an opposite of a Manic Pixie Dream Girl, because I think Manic Pixie Dream Girls are a very specifically constructed thing for a very specific purpose. Like, they're meant to be the, like, love interest of a male-driven film and exist for no other reason than that, as opposed to, I just think that this is a movie that's just a strong female lead.
I'm kind of with Claire on that one. I think she's definitely a subversion of a type that you would see, and I almost feel like, I mean, all the John Hughes references, I think, are in this movie are really, are kind of a good sign pointer to that, because I do sort of feel like, I mean, I know that Olive, the character, really idolizes John Hughes. There we differ, but, I mean, the guy made a good movie, but you know, some of that shit ain't aged well. I kind of almost feel like Olive is, if anything, she's an inversion of, like, the Ally Sheedy character in The Breakfast Club. Which is not quite Manic Pixie Dream Girl, because that's a bit of a darker sort of vibe, right? Yeah. Like, because Ally Sheedy is sort of playing this kind of, like, fucked up, the rumors say she's, like, the school nympho. She's, you know, there's a kind of weird, fucked up, gothy thing. But in The Breakfast Club, like in so many of John Hughes' movies, she's such a type. She's just a type. And I kind of feel like, and we do get to know her a little bit in The Breakfast Club, but even then, everybody there stays a type in a weird way. Whereas with Easy A, I think it's the same kind of character, but as you said, seen from the inside, where... like, it's like the sort of the school, for lack of a better term, like, put this in quotes, like the school slut or whatever, like the fucked up slutty girl or whatever. And it's, but we're seeing it from her point of view, and we're seeing that she's a fully formed human being. So yes, I do believe there is a subversion there. I think it's maybe a different type.
And like the thing that I find is it acknowledges the filmic framework, like right from the get-go, where she's like, you know, oh, and like how many movies start with this like, woe is me, teenager kind of thing. And I mean, in a lot of ways, it apes the form in an interesting way, like especially of like John Hughes films. Like when we were watching it last night, I was talking to Heather and I was like, oh, every one of these guys she's mentioning is kind of a monster in a way, if you go back to the film and look at it now. And she's like, just let me have Jake. And I'm like, okay, I'll lay off of Jake, but the rest of them are jerks. Jake's still a jerk too, really, when you deconstruct everything. But yeah, it's funny because it's like holding up the aspirational elements, but it's still acknowledging the problematic elements of the source material that it draws inspiration from. This was Will Gluck's first film, or second film that he directed. I mean, he'd done a lot of production stuff prior to that in TV, and Burt V. Royal, this was his first screenplay to make it to stage. He'd had he'd done a Fringe play that received a lot of positive press, that's a GLAAD award. But one of the things I find really interesting looking at the performances of everything in this is there's like a humanity to all of the characters. Like, there's sharp, like I mentioned earlier, like sort of Mrs. Maisel or Gilmore Girls-y back and forth, but it never feels like cartoonish. You don't get quiplash that you can get from watching like either of those shows.
Any Sherman Palladino joints. Yeah.
And I mean, I love them, but they you go in, it's like, nobody talks like this.
It's Gilmore Girls. Gilmore Girls is like, good God, normal humans don't talk like this.
Yeah. Now, do you feel like, how do you like, do you, the dialogue, do you feel like it, that kind of pace elevated the humor, or how do you feel it impacted the delivery there?
I mean, I think it's sharp and smart, and like it, you're aware that it's a script, you know, a screenplay. I don't think you can't not, it's a comedy, it's a teenage comedy, but like, it never takes me out of it, because I think they just hired a bunch of really good actors who are capable of making it their own.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, yeah, I do, and it's a bit elevated, it's a bit stylized, obviously, mm-hmm. like so many teen comedies are, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that if it's done well, and in this case, I think it is. And also, I think just because of the subject matter, it's probably very necessary in
yes.
this case, because like the story of a young woman in high school whose reputation suffers because of like rumors of promiscuity, that's some heavy, awful shit in real life.
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. it's really terrible, scarring things that can really truly wreck someone's life. Because we live in a horrible society. So I think that it probably, to address the things that they were getting at in this movie, it was probably necessary to heighten all of that so that you can kind of soar over all of the real dark stuff, so that you can actually look at the sort of bigger ideas that they were looking at, you know, without getting bogged down in like people's trauma.
Yeah. I remember about halfway through the movie, I kind of went online, and because I didn't know who wrote the movie, and I was like, I wonder. I assumed it was a man, because I just kind of all assumed that Hollywood feature films are written by men, but mm-hmm. like I was like, I wonder if a woman had a hand in writing this. She did not. There are a few points where I feel like it would have been helpful, but not very many. I think for the most part, they did a pretty smart job with it.
Yeah, pretty tapped into the humanity of everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, this is off of a first viewing, but yeah, I didn't catch anything where I was like, I really wish they could have laid off, I wish they could have laid off all of the horror stuff a little bit more. That's a little, I don't know, I kind of feel that that's not, I mean, you know, it's a way that shitty teenagers talk, and it's a way that shitty people talk, so like there's that, but I don't know, it's tricky because it's not quite what they're actually talking about.
Yeah, and I think in the last
money's the water.
Yeah, and in the last 10 years we've gotten, I think, you know, shitty people still do talk like that, but I think we've gotten better about how we address these things. So what I find interesting is I think if they did this film now, you wouldn't have 21-year-olds playing all of these teenagers. You'd have teenagers playing all of these teenagers, because like that's I think.
I don't know about that. Most teenagers that I know of, I mean, in these kind of films and stuff and TV shows, are still played by mid-20s.
Well, it's tricky because I think especially like in the 80s with like the sex comedies and stuff like that, mm-hmm. a lot of the reason that the characters were cast older was so that they could film these actors in sexual situations with one another. Whereas like if your actors are 16, 17, that becomes like a problem, and also like kind of a danger. It becomes a safety issue in a lot of ways. So... But, you know, this is also, I mean, this is a story where not much actually happens
on camera.
Like, it's all imaginary.
True.
Like, all of the sex in this is pretty much imaginary.
That's true. That gives it more license.
Yeah, I mean, I think, if you look at Booksmart, where they cast, I mean, that being said, I guess when trying to do the math on Booksmart, I think they probably would have, like, every, like, the teenagers were all real, like, the cast of this were all, like, 20, 21, except for the one guy where they notably marked, oh, he's failed four times.
Cam, sweet Cam Gidgenet is so good. Yeah. He's so bland unless he's playing dumb, like, unless he's playing that kind of character. And I was actually pleasantly surprised because I've seen him, I mean, he's been in Twilight, and he's been in Burlesque, a.k.a. The Greatest Show of All Time.
Is that,
and, yeah.
Is that actor, he's like a known quantity? Because he just seems like such a, like a, like a third bill, was in two movies 20 years ago sort of guy.
He was. You know? I mean, he was in that time period. I think he started to become kind of like the it guy, and then, like, he just kind of never really went anywhere.
Okay.
But this is, like, by far my favorite performance of his, because he just got to play, like, a dumb Christian dude.
Yeah, and I liked it. I thought it was fun.
Yeah, he's funny.
It is what I found funny too is, like, you have one actor who is in Twilight and they reference Twilight. You have an actor who was in Gossip Girls and they reference Gossip Girls. So it's like I almost wonder, it's like, if there is a conscious decision to
oh, because probably.
That is, like, that's a bit of a coincidence. Once, sure, but, like, two, three times where you're referencing the same people.
Is that where Penn Badgley is from? Is Gossip Girl?
Yeah. So.
I was so in love with him.
I got to bring this up because this is one of my favorite tweets that ever happened. This is Meredith Cheesebro, a Toronto comedian. She's a member of Tall Sci, the sketch duo. One of my absolute favorite tweets is one of hers, and it is literally just, I'm quoting Meredith Cheesebro here. Penn Badgley sounds like a name a guy made up while a cop was writing him a ticket.
That is a very accurate observation.
Yep.
The movie is very reliant on pop culture, and referential humor. I mean, referential writing. I mean, Scarlet Letter. Yeah. For all of Struggle with Identity, and there's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, tying back to Brandon, where there's, like, a funny sort of, like, they play with the timeline, because technically she goes, like when she references, oh, my apologies to Mark Twain, but she is, that's her fourth wall breaking, because she mentioned that in the video chat, which is technically taking place after that, so it's sort of, like, again playing with the structure.
Yeah.
Now, your own material is very referential and pop culture laden. I mean, like, there's the, I know if your Sketchfest show, there's the framing device of the video game that you used.
Yeah.
They're deconstructed those tropes, and your sexy plague doctor's sketch, which is hilarious. But it feels like it's a fine line between, like, how referential do you go? So how do you balance that? Like, the film does it really well. I never feel lost watching the film. Like, I always I can see it. So how do you, when you're writing your sketches, how do you balance, like, how deep to reference, how far to go, and how to balance that out?
I think we generally do, but, like, a third pop culture sketches. Most of our sketches come from, like, things that we find in our lives that are either, like, anxieties or worries or fears or things that we are annoyed by or stuff like that. And then we'll throw in some nerdy stuff because it often coincides with our mutual interests or my interests or stuff like that.
Well, and we're nerds. I mean, I feel like you're more of a nerd than I am.
I am more of the nerd. Yeah, I'm a bigger nerd.
Like, you know, I'm from that world. I speak nerd.
Yeah, I wasn't like, hey, Ryan, I want to do this video game opening. And you're like, what's a video game? Like,
yeah. and I think the thing is as well that I do think that's an element of our sort of vibe currently. I do feel like some of that had to do with just, I think the more comfortable we get with each other just as, like, collaborators or whatever, I kind of feel like we're dropping that a little bit, and it's allowing things to get a bit more personal and a bit more mm-hmm. sort of emotionally grounded than because I think what happens a lot of the time in comedy is that, you know, you meet someone, you want to work with them, and then there's this kind of period where you're sort of feeling each other out. Even if you like each other, even if everything's fine, you're getting along, you know, which I think has always been the case with us. Where, like, so many collaborations in comedy just fail. Like, they just, you know, they trail off, or they don't work, or they work really good for two shows, and then, you know, somebody gets in something popular, and then you can never schedule rehearsals or whatever. So I think people are kind of initially on guard, and so I think a lot of the stuff you pitch is a bit more arm's length and is a bit more dependent on pop culture and dependent on, like, it's kind of stuff you can put out there without any risk to yourself, any sort of personal risk. And I think that we've established the fact that, you know, like, this is a long-term collaboration, I think that we've gotten better at just sort of like, well, no, let's do sketches about things that make us sad, you know?
Yeah, I think there came a point where we were starting to get a reputation of being like, we were the nerdy troupe. And I was like, I don't want to be that. I mean, like, I think most of the times that, like, when our sketches have nerdy kind of references, it's literally just because they're a part of either of our lives. Like, you know, I'll sit around and be like, hey, you know what bugs me is how inaccurate, like, CSI TV shows are. Let's make something about that. We never sit down or like, oh, all right, what nerdy things can we skewer today? It's just, I mean, like all comedy, it's just kind of coming from, like, things in our lives that have inspired us or made us laugh or make us angry. So, like, I don't think it's ever a conscious choice. It's like, yeah,
no.
It's kind of just pulling from the good and the bad.
Well, and to bring it back to Easy A, mm-hmm. I think that the reason that, you know, the viewer doesn't get lost in the references is the same reason that, you know, a really highly referential show like Community works, or like, it's not, yes, those references are there. Yes, they're sort of providing some of the grounding, but it's more important that it work on its own and that the references be just sort of like bonus texture.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I kind of feel like Easy A, it does that really well. Even if you know nothing about Nathaniel Hawthorne, even if you know, like, if you're just watching it and you think this is like a pure story that's like made up from whole cloth and doesn't come from anywhere, you can still follow it. It still makes sense. There's still emotional investment in it. And I kind of feel like that's maybe how we come at that stuff in our comedy as well, is that, like, great, let's do a CSI thing, or let's make sure that there's something personal there. Let's make sure that there's, that it's not just like a TV joke, you know?
You have to take care of your audience, and I think this movie does it really well. Like, even, you know, I don't know John Hughes. Like, I've seen The Breakfast Club once. Like, I don't care for it. I mean, it's fine. But, like, all we needed was the shot of the guy in the lawnmower to be like, oh, and now I get this reference. Okay, yeah. Cool. Like, you don't need to be, I think they were clever, and they gave us a lot of references that, like, if it meant something, they'd set it up and they'd let us know why.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things I find really I like about this film is that, like, it threads a needle between some positive and problematic representation, but it always seems to land on the side of empathy with these characters, even like the evangelical group, which watching and like in a lesser film would just be straight up monsters. It establishes an emotional core to these villains. You know, they're the villains. They're the antagonists. Mm-hmm. So it gives them humanity, which I think is missing in a lot of films like this, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, like, so do you feel that, like, that compassion is an important part of making these comedies really work?
I think especially for this film, it has to be, when you're writing a movie about a teenage girl dealing with the stuff that she's dealing with. Like, I think this kind of movie could have gone very, very wrong. In the wrong hands and in less compassionate hands. Like, there are even some moments in it, you know, when she says, you know, everyone hates me. I'm starting to hate myself too. I'm like, ooh, let's unpack that. Oh, we're not going to? Okay. Like, I want to know why, what exactly, you know, what she's doing, why she hates herself for it. Because I think it does a pretty good job of painting her in a really positive light. And, but I think the older we get and the smarter we get about talking about these things, I would have liked to have seen the film address the stigma around the concept of slut.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A little bit more, because at the end of the day, it's still a bad thing in this film. And that was, you know, that was the one thing that I'm like, oh, I wish that there had been a female writer on this film, because I would have appreciated maybe like trying to see them delve in, have that conversation, as opposed to her, you know, she does the sexy montage where she kind of embraces it, but at the end of the day, oh, she's not sleeping with these people. Like, it's okay. It's not happening. She's not a slut. Like, the closest we get is Patricia Clarkson in that lovely moment in the car where she's like, oh, yeah, I slept with everybody. I was a giant slut. And I'm like, but, like, why do we have to, I wanted them to unpack it, and they never did. And I think that, to me, watching this, because I haven't seen it for a couple of years, that was the one aspect of the film that I wish that they'd explored more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think if that film was maybe made today, it might have been more comfortable with addressing those issues. I don't know. I think I'm finding that films today seem to be better at doing that with these younger audiences, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other things I found interesting, it's like 2010, so it was released in 2010. It's, in a lot of ways, it embraces information technology as a plot of like as a device within the film in an interesting way. Like, Facebook is name checked. You got phones and as for people texting, as they're actual, you know, plot devices. They're not just something, some like, oh, these kids in their phones. It actually keeps the story moving forward. Now, do you feel that that's possible, that it could date the film in any way? Like, do you think that, like, when using something of the moment like that, do you think there's a risk to potentially, like, make it inaccessible down the road, or?
I don't think so. I mean, the film is already dated itself in having phones that flip.
Yes.
So, I mean, well, like...
And in Netflix being a series of DVDs that come to you in the mail.
Yeah.
Stanley Tucci is flipping through at one point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my short answer is no. I mean, I think, like, no and yes. Like, yes, it is dated, but I don't think that's a detriment. I don't know how you'd avoid that. And social bullying, if anything else, like, social media bullying is even more of a problem than it used to be. So if anything, this was just the start.
Yeah.
Yeah, technology is always going to date a thing, but it doesn't, a movie can be of a time and still not date it. You know what I mean? Like, there are great movies from the 50s that are obviously, all those cars are 1950s cars, and the only way that people can remotely communicate is by the phone. But if it's a good story and it's a good movie, everyone just kind of goes, ah, well, it was the 50s. That's all you need.
Yep.
So, like, I mean, I kind of feel like, yeah, technology is always going to date, but a good story doesn't date.
I think that comes back to the emotional core. Like, there's a genuine compassion for all of the characters in this. It's like one of the things, sort of as a side note, kind of one of the funny things I found is, like, all of Olive's family are named after food. So you've got
Oh, really?
Chip, Chip is her
oh, God.
Little brother.
I missed that.
Rosemary is her mom, and Dill is her dad. In the scripts I read, her older brother's name is Kale.
She has an older brother?
That's
George. Yes, she does. Yeah. Yeah.
He's in university, and originally he was in it, and they cut his character, but his name was Kale.
Oh, my God.
And one of the things is when Todd...
That's just a writer fucking around.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
but watching it just now, I was like, oh, wait a second. The moment that she lets Todd into her life, she is right after the lobster hat, and she starts calling him Lobster
Todd. Yeah.
So it's like this through line of the people that she can truly trust are all food-based. Kind of thing. It's just, I just found like such a weird little thing there for a moment. It's like, and like, yeah, it probably was just the writer having fun with that. But it's
playing a little game with himself while he's in the final draft.
Yeah.
Now,
the father's original name was Turkey, and then they changed it.
I did want to say before I forget this. I think you're right. I think that a great thing about the script is that it does sort of always come back to the humanity of everybody. Mm-hmm. But then also nobody's a saint. Like, that was the other thing I really loved. Just that, oh, God, I can't remember his name. Her friend, her gay friend. That
Mary,
she's
yeah.
Brandon.
Yeah. Brandon, you know, has that beautiful moment where he, like, basically, like, begs her to pretend that she slept with him. And you just see, like, the raw pain of being like a gay kid in high school, and just he never says it, but you get the feeling that he's on the edge of being suicidal. Like, and like they go there and you feel it. And the reason that, you know, and it's a big enough crisis that she feels she needs to respond to it. And it makes sense. But then like he fucking turns around and sells her out to all like the losers of the school.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take away the fact that that's where he is, but then it's also like he's also not a saint. Or Lisa Kudrow's character, right? Like she did a fucked up thing. She slept with a student, like whether he was of age or not, that's fucked up. But you see where she's coming from and you know why she did it, and you know, Emma Stone has this moment of compassion for her, and then it bites her in the ass later. Like, you know.
Yep.
And it's like, so nobody's a saint, but also nobody's just like a straight up monster. Like I really enjoy that kind of storytelling.
I just find throughout is like every character there's an emotional depth to them. Like even I'm forgetting the name of the character, but Mr. Griffith, I think it is, the teacher.
Thomas Hayden Church's character?
Yeah, Thomas Hayden Church's character. Or it's just like, we've all had that teacher who's like trying to be cool, and every once in a while they were a little bit cool, but then...
I'm not gonna rap, I'm not gonna stop
that. Yeah, yeah. Remember, Earth Day's tomorrow. Okay.
Oh my God.
That was a beautiful line.
So good.
Such a beautiful example of subtext. I love it.
Yeah.
I also forgot that Fred Armisen is in this movie. And he's so funny for like the 30 seconds he's in there.
Yeah.
The second time she knocks over the framed picture on his desk and his reaction is just, come on!
I know.
The dumbest thing, and it's perfect.
I know.
Before we start wrapping up and everything, are there any moments or anything that you want to maybe highlight before we wrap up for the film?
I mean, it just goes back to your original question. Anytime Stanley and Patricia are on camera, like anything that they do, like when they're like, you kind of look like a stripper, but a high-class stripper for governors and athletes. My favorite line in the whole film.
Yeah.
There's
a lot going on in that line.
Oh, it's so good.
I did like Lisa Kudrow's line about the student brought a knife to school. I mean, it was a butter knife, but that is a gateway knife. Like there's a thing some of the lines are so out there absurd like that. And it's really, I think it's a real testament to the actors that they like grounded everything enough that, that you kind of don't notice how whacked out some of that dialogue is.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Like if you watch Superbad, they're great performers, and but the dialogue is so bananas they can't save that from just feeling like a silly movie. Whereas this film, you know, around the same time, one of the same performers, and just they're able to take dialogue that's super silly and just give it heart. That is like, I can see this coming from a genuine place in that moment. Like if I was with that person and this was real life, I could see that coming from that person and not never feeling sort of fake and filmy.
Yeah.
Now, do you think this is an important film, like a film people really should try to watch?
I mean, I always want people to watch Easy A. I love the fact that Todd, the character, is there to be essentially like the supportive boyfriend he plays. I find that his role is very feminine, in the sense that like he's just kind of there to support her, and like there to make her dreams kind of come true. And I like that about him. And I like that he asks her before he does anything. Like, and he's like he does everything that he's supposed to. And he's also just there to be pretty. And I think this film does a lot of interesting things with gender roles, I think, which I really like. So, I mean, I always want people to watch Easy A. I think it's very smart.
I mean,
it's important to change the world.
Yeah. I mean, important's a hard term to figure out, right? Because I don't know if there's any sort of, I don't know if there's such a thing as objective importance. Like, I think maybe a movie like Selma or something might be like just across the board important. But I find movies are more often important sort of contextually. I kind of feel like this is a movie that, if the right young person in the right situation saw it, it might be very important to them. It's a very silly, cleverer than average teen comedy for sure.
Yeah.
It's worth watching. I think people should watch it. I mean, Emma Stone's great. The writing's fun. A few things have aged a little squickily, but there's nothing monstrous going on in it, I don't think. I don't know. It's worth a watch, and it's an interesting, very humane sort of look at the sort of trauma of sort of sexuality in high school. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah.
Now, one of the things I like about it is that it never, like, even when Emma Stone's character, when Olive was talking about the sex that she pretended to have at the very beginning, it kind of cuts away in a way. It fades out and does a voiceover, so you never really have that. It's like there's no explicit moments really. There's that. It's all about the heart of the characters. So I agree. And I mean, like, important is a very subjective term. I think as something I definitely recommend because of that, where it's like you want to see a movie where characters have heart, watch this movie. And that treats the subject matter in a delicate sense from 2010.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So.
And also on top of that all, like, to just get back to like its function as a comedy, it is legitimately very funny.
Funny movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Two last wrap-up questions for you. So I asked this of my guests, because we've all had different performance experiences, in comedy and drama for you both. What is your most bananas, like crazy experience performing? Like, could be like situational, location. I had one person who performed at a nude beach. Another who did a bachelorette party, like did comedy. So what, as far as like perform, and it doesn't necessarily have to be location, but experientially, what is your strangest, most funny, bananas performance experience?
I mean, I've twice been hired to get really drunk and perform Shakespeare.
Oh yeah.
I've played Juliet and Beatrice from Much Ado But Nothing in full stage productions where my whole purpose was to get shittered and do the entire play. I think that counts.
Yeah. Yeah.
For a theater company.
Was this question being asked back the last time I did the show, Matthew?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Because if it had, I would have already told this story, but since this is a new question, I can tell this story. I was in a play in 2007 or something like that in Edmonton. Is a British, the British sort of late 60s comedy playwright, Joe Orton, is a sort of a very controversial at the time figure, as openly gay as I think you could get in the late 60s in England, wrote a very strange farce called What the Butler Saw.
And I
played the sergeant, the sort of cockney sergeant who shows up like halfway through to sort of cause even more trouble. It's a farce, so there's lots of in and out of doors and people being mistaken for other people and people wearing each other's clothes and being mistaken for those people because nobody's looking any deeper than the uniform and all that kind of stuff. And the sort of climactic moment of the play in this production that was directed by amazing Canadian director Ron Jenkins was the skylight in the ceiling opened up, like just sort of fell open, and this like blaring white light just sort of shines down into the sort of room that the whole play happens in, and Carmina Burana by Orff starts playing like that da 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 that song, and then this huge silver ladder just gets sort of lowered into like this gleaming silver ladder in this blinding white light, and then my character climbs down the ladder. My character climbs down the ladder in like a skin tight leopard print dress and a giant like Wilma Flintstone red beehive wig covered in blood.
Oh my lord.
And then just sort of climbs down the ladder while Carmina Burana is blaring and all the other characters are all in their underwear at this point cowering below me. Every night the crowd went nuts. It was like a rock concert for a second. just because it was so out there and it was so the play starts and it's just this everybody's it's very 60s British, it's very stiff, everybody's being very British. And then as the play goes on, like it gets to the point where everybody's shooting at each other and covered in blood and in their underwear and like so it's just this complete collapse of society, right? And it's so they were ready for it at that point, and it was like, I was like, every time I did it, I was like, I will never get an entrance this good again. And I haven't.
I can't believe I've known you for like over three, well, I mean like really known you for 3 years, and I've never heard that story.
Well, this was years ago. I mean, this was like 13, 14 years ago.
No, so, I'm just saying like I'm shocked It's never come up.
So now you have to write something where Ryan gets to enter to like bombastic music covered in blood.
Great.
Yeah, I've already done it.
Yeah. I'll work on it. Our next sketch show is going to be insane.
Okay, well, if people wanted to read you or watch you perform online, where can they find you?
Claire gets very regularly published at the Beaverton. She's one of the writers for the Beaverton.
Yeah, I would say for myself, follow me on Twitter at Claire Blackwood. The Whiskey Kids are at Those Whiskey Kids, I think, on Twitter.
Those Whiskey Kids, yeah.
Yeah, or you can find us on Facebook as well.
Excellent.
But Ryan, where are you mostly?
I am mostly unemployed and looking for a day job. No, I'm at Those Whiskey Kids. I'm at like on my socials are like Ryan F. Hughes, all one word. Come check me out. I post intermittently.
And I'm on Twitter too much.
Yeah, awesome. Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. And thanks for listening to Comedy Album Book Club.
Well, yeah, thanks for having us.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.